Thank you so much, everybody, for coming. We're really excited to be here and talking about big data and health. My name is Emily Hackle. I work at Edelman, and we help companies tell their stories in ways that build trust, foster action, build business. And today, the story that we're going to tell here is about big data and health. I don't know how many of you have read Eric Topol's The Creative Destruction of Medicine. I'm just starting to get into it, but he starts off by saying that there is one theme, one reason why creative destruction is ready to go, and it's because it's for the first time in history we can digitize human beings. So all of us, whether we're walking with our cell phones, looking something up in Google, we're leaving data in our wake. And there's a lot of data that's new and emerging that we should be considering. So there's the genomic data, which today is really within reach for a lot of people, a lot more. Life Technologies announced at the end of 2011 that they're able to map an entire genome for $1,000 in one day, which is pretty incredible. There's health data that's being captured by our doctors and providers with EHRs and PHRs. Today, you know, only a quarter of physicians and about 15% of hospitals, according to the ONC, are actually capturing this data, but with the $27 billion incentive payments that are going to be distributed over the next decade, this is bound to increase. I think majority of people will actually have their digital health records digitally. And there's also passive and behavioral data, which is what we're going to be talking mostly about, and it's the data that you leave in your wake, your digital exhaust, so to speak, that's a result of the behavior. So your call history, your Twitter updates, Facebook likes. People today are sending over 2 trillion text messages a year, and almost 70% of people sleep with cell phones next to them. And now this goes up to about 90% for those 30 and under. And you also have to think about the quantified self devices, the body medias, the Fitbits, and others. Our data is everywhere. So this is really a new era of medicine, I believe. I'm really hopeful about it, one in which each person can be almost fully defined at the individual level versus the population level, which is how we practice today. It's mass screening policies, same doses, same products for, you know, people with what may seem like similar backgrounds, and we'll really be able to, with this data, look at a patient level versus population, moving away from evidence-based. So what is the opportunity for us? I'm just going to step back for a quick second. On a personal level, we're hoping to engage in a rounds of debate here, but I really believe that there's an opportunity, and actually when you mentioned Disney, there's an opportunity for all companies across every industry to engage in health, and there's actually a consumer expectation for that to happen. And an environment when trust in business is fairly low. It's about 53% globally and 50% in the U.S., and that's taken actually from some Edelman Trust Barometer data that was launched a couple of months ago. It's a 30,000-person, 25-country study. So the trust in business is low, but actually trust is increased by engagement in health. And there's an opportunity to not only help businesses' reputation and bottom line, but also the public well-being by engaging in this. And perhaps data is actually one way to get there, because companies are already doing it. So getting back to the topic at hand, so we promoted this panel by saying we have a little bit of a secret. You know, STDs are good for your health. And it's really socially transmitted data. It's good. People may be scared of it, but it's actually, I think, a positive thing. So your Twitter stream, your grocery receipts, et cetera, they can hold the key to better personal and public health. So you might be thinking, wow, well, you know, 30,000 people at South By, maybe we can save the world with all of our data. So before we get into actually the specifics, I want you to think about throughout this panel what way that you personally and your companies and organizations should be using your data or can consider using your data, or maybe even stopping it, and what ethical and privacy implications are important to consider. So that's a quick intro from me, and now we're actually going to have each person, esteemed panelist, introduce him or herself through the data that they have, through their own personal data, and that way you can get a better peek into their point of view and what their trail leaves. So I will turn this over to Anmol for a moment.
Should
I
set up
register
for
you? Do it from here.
Okay, so my name is Anmol. I am computer scientist by training. I, about a year ago, with my co-founder, Karan Singh, we ended up starting this company called Ginger.io. We use large amounts of data that already exists in mobile phones, movement, communication, various other sensors, build models of a person's behavior and tied to health outcomes. And that's based on some of the research I did when I was at MIT. So I'll tell you a story based on my data, which sort of quickly pulled together. So this is just three kinds of features that are collected from my life for a week, about 10 days before South by. And so one of, you know, obviously it's a week data. You can see the sort of Sunday to Saturday. One of them is a movement statistic. The other one sort of interaction is how many unique individuals I interact with. And the third one's a score based on my communication style. And so by itself, this data may not mean much, but maybe I'll add a couple of events that happened in my life. So the first one is, you know, I don't know how many of you worked at a startup, but this is what a three-day weekend at a startup looks like. And so that Monday was actually President's Day. And so you can see that, you know, it was supposed to be a holiday, but our whole team was in at work, and people were in at 9 a.m., and it was just a really busy day. And those little sort of, that heat map is actually my movement. I've taken out the sort of map part of it and just left the heat map. And then the second part of being a startup person is sort of you go through these phases where you're sort of doing a lot of meetings and events like this, and then you go back into being programmer mode. And usually that often happens when my co-founder is traveling and I can sort of hide away in a closet. And so you see these sort of changes, you know, in my various features as soon as, you know, Karan flies out that day and then all of this starts happening. So not statistically significant, but just a quick story about what's, you know, how this data might be informative. Oh, sorry. Last thing I should add is if you are interested in seeing your own data, you can sign up with one of us, so Karan's right here, or me, and we'll actually get you the app so you can play with your own data as well.
Hi, I'm David Hale. I'm the project lead for the Pillbox Initiative at the National Library of Medicine, and this is my genome. Any questions? Okay, so the data, the raw data itself, isn't really meaning, doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. But when you connect it to research data and medical information, then you begin to have you know, a lot of significance with this. And it's important for me because being adopted, I grew up without a family medical history. So the only thing my parents actually were told when they adopted me was that I was half Narragansett Indian, which led to a lot of culturally inappropriate baby pictures. That's a tomahawk in my hand. So, however, when I made it to the National Library of Medicine, I got involved in Native American health information outreach as a way to connect with, you know, that part of my heritage. And then when I finally got around to, you know, participating in personal genomics testing to get that surrogate family medical history, you know, really, I got a lot more than I bargained for. On this graph, Native American DNA shows up as orange. There isn't a drop of Native American DNA in me. I am more African than I am Native American. So, you know, really just sort of a bit of a shock to me. And when I say bit of a shock, I mean deep spiritual crisis. But I did get my surrogate family medical history. I got my disease risks, and I know that I have wet earwax. So that's okay, great. But also, you know, that really, you know, affected me on a deep level. And, you know, personal health data to me is very personal. That, along with, you know, my friends ePatient Dave, who's, you know, probably the leading crusader for patients' rights to their data, and medical advocacy muralist Regina Holiday, who translates this whole movement through art. Between all of them, I decided to write a song about patients' rights to access their health data and actually perform it at health and medical conferences.
You know, so I'll be at the local bar later.
No. Yeah, actually, yeah, I've got my uke, so I'll be playing that later. Yeah, but I want you to know, like this, you know, as I talk about opening government data and government's interactions with citizens, you know, private health data, you know, this is a deeply personal topic for me. And so I want to thank every one of you for coming and sharing this with us today.
Hi, everybody. So let's do this. That'd be great. So I'm Mark Dredzi. I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins University, not in the medical school. We have other things that we do, too. I know. Everyone. When I first started there, everyone's like, oh, you're in the medical school. No. And so what I normally do to give you an idea of my background is what we call statistical natural language processing, which I know at least two people in the room know what that is. maybe more, hopefully more. So basically what that is we use statistics to try and understand language, not programming languages, but languages that people here speak. And also we build tools for automatically processing those languages in some way. So like machine translation, speech recognition, web search, those sorts of things. If everyone saw Watson on Jeopardy last year, so or Siri, those are the types of things I think about. So in terms of data, I'm really interested in health data. At Hopkins, we do have a lot of clinical data, so I've been really kind of getting interested in that. And not necessarily about individual patients, but thinking about from population health level. So imagine if you had patient data for 1 million people, what could you learn, right? You could imagine that you could discover a lot of really interesting things that improve patient care and help us come up with a cheaper or more effective healthcare system. The other thing I think about, which is why I'm here, is social media data and how social media data can impact health. And for someone with the background that I have, it's really fascinating because we have just tremendous volumes of data freely available on the internet. If you look at my field 15 years ago, the only thing we had were copies of the Wall Street Journal. That was like our example of human language. And now you can download terabytes of language data from places like Twitter. It's really quite exciting. So that's why I'm here, and that's how I think about the world. This is my Google search history over the last couple of days. So if you look carefully, you can kind of see what I'm thinking about, the conferences I'm thinking about going to, and papers I'm thinking about writing. So if you do recognize what I'm thinking about, I would ask you don't scoop any ideas I have. Thanks. Just thinking about like a couple people in the room who might scoop it. Okay.
I'm Devin McGraw. I'm the director of the Health Privacy Project at a nonprofit called the Center for Democracy and Technology. It's mostly in Washington, D.C., but we do have a cool little office in San Francisco, probably more to make us cool than that we're actually doing work out of it. There's only two people there. But I don't have a slide with data on it. And one reason why I don't is because it's none of your business what my health data is. Having said that, the other reason why I don't have a slide with my data is that I don't have my data. I don't collect it regularly, but I know that lots of other people do. Every time I go to the drugstore to fill a prescription, my data gets collected by CVS, and it probably gets combined with everything else that I buy in CVS, which, since I live in the city of Washington where we have almost no grocery stores, is pretty much where I buy just about everything that I need. So I know they have a pretty robust profile on me, but I've never seen it. I don't think I could actually get it if I asked for it. And to me, those are sort of important sort of pieces of advocacy around data and making sure that as people are sharing it more ubiquitously for good, that we make sure that we are promoting the rights of individuals with respect to data that can be quite personal about them. Now, that's not to say that I think that we shouldn't be pursuing big data in health, because in fact, I think we should. I think it's important to use data to learn about our own personal health, as well as to learn about population health, so that we can improve the way we take care of people in this country. We know that our statistics are way off and that they can be better, and we pay a very high price for the fact that they're not. And they're not going to get better without data. So it is absolutely critical that we find ways to access big data, to mine it, to utilize it, to analyze it in every way we possibly can. But we have to find a way to do that in a way that is trusted by the public. And that's where the privacy pieces come in. And we'll be talking a little bit about that during our session today.
Great. So thank you. So let's start off with some questions about how big data can actually be used to improve personal health. So there's a lot of talk these days, Anmol, about big data. I'm curious as to how you're using it specifically at Ginger.io to reveal patterns in human behavior and information about people's health that they may not even know themselves. So if you can talk specifically about that and just shed some light on how you're working to do that.
Absolutely. So I'll give you a quick background on Ginger.io. We started about a year ago. We initially started out as a sort of consumer app, and it was, we tested with our friends and family, got some interesting feedback, And the challenge with being a consumer app, I think it works really well if you're targeting sort of the quantified self community or people who are in the health and fitness community, and some companies have done it really well. But the challenge is in healthcare, and especially in the sort of medical system or chronic care, there's really no model of patients paying to install apps or buy devices. And I think that was one thing we learned pretty early on. And what we ended up becoming is sort of a sort of B2B2C business, right? Which is we build this platform that helps, that we deploy with, whether it's providers or whether it's researchers, that helps people manage their health and helps people collect this sort of data and build better models. And then, obviously, whenever you do something of this sort, you have to have patients opt in to the system and sort of be part of that process, and giving patients value is really important. But the business part of it comes from some of the enterprises that are interested in the populations. And there's a few variants of that. So there's a variant which is around, there's early adopters at places like Disney and Johns Hopkins who are sort of researchers or innovators who want to try this out with their system. And so they're obviously sort of the people you want to start with. But what's happening across the ecosystem is there's now things like the admission penalties and ACOs and this broader movement towards becoming a population management kind of industry versus a fee-based model. And so technologies like us, or technologies like the Fitbit or the Bases or any other tool, can actually fit in really well within that model. So I think both of those are interesting areas to look at.
And do you want to talk a little bit about this slide here?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, this gets to how do you really do predictions using this data, right? Because the first time I have this conversation with people, they look at me like I'm crazy. And this is an example from one of our papers, which is, you know, here's what the behavior signature of stress with this particular population looks like. And so we have three features. One of them is communication, another one's entropy, and a third one is related movement. And you see statistically significant differences for a normal day, which is a symptomatic day, where the normal day is on the left and then the symptomatic is on the right for this population. And that's an example of the kinds of models you could build, essentially use these sort of machine learning models to start predicting something's changed with this person. I see a red, yellow, green, and that's a check engine light that someone, whether it's a family member or a nurse or a caregiver, someone can potentially intervene and help that person.
Great, thank you, Anmol. David, I'm hoping we can move to you now, and you can help us understand a little bit about government's role in all of this, what the responsibility is for government and opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line, the ultimate goal is improving the health of Americans. I mean, everything else that we talk about, reducing the burden on the healthcare system, promoting innovation, opening data, the end result is always the same. It's always about improving the health of Americans. Did anyone have a chance to see Todd Park yesterday? Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Well, I'll sort of give you the summary of that. I mean, so all of these initiatives, like the Open Government Initiative, health.data.gov, which is the nation's clearinghouse for government health data, and programs like the Health Data Initiative, or what we're calling the Health Data Palooza, that's happening this June in D.C., working with the Department of Health and Human Services, it's to create a community around this type of data. So it's not just government pushing data out and saying, here's all the data, obviously you should be able to improve your health with it. It's about all the steps in between. It's about creating communities and conversations so the data is used in meaningful ways, so that health IT developers have what they need to develop valid business models and that they can understand and work with this data. But that's all the big data. But actually what I want to talk about is sort of the smaller pieces of data, the data that we're sharing as citizens and kind of the significance of that, and then maybe the role that government, specifically the National Library of Medicine, can play. Can you hit the next slide? So in terms of health information, this is the NLM's role, acquire, organize, and preserve, biomedical health data. But now, with citizens being able to generate their own data, share it through social networks, and using technology from the quantified self movement, it's changed a little bit. Now, for citizens, it's generate, organize, and act on that information. I mean, that final point is the key one, because for a citizen, health data means action. It means an impact, whether it's for you or whether it's for someone that you're caring for in your family or in your community. But the overlap, that middle term, organize, that's something where I think the National Library of Medicine can play a key role. So at the National Library of Medicine, we, in addition to things like PubMed, which is peer-reviewed literature, and Medline Plus, which is consumer health information, if you come to the National Library of Medicine website and if you search on Medline Plus, we're also exposing a lot of our data through APIs, application programming interfaces. For those of you that aren't familiar with them, these are just software tools that let developers build iPhone apps or EHRs or, you know, other kinds of health records and connect them to this data. So now you're sharing your information through Facebook or something else. Maybe Ginger.io is grabbing that data and maybe they need to normalize it. Maybe you're saying, oh, I'm coughing, I might have a cold. Well, they can send that information to us and we can connect that to all of the specific terms and then research and consumer health information. So you don't see what we're doing, but we're just kind of the back end that's helping power all of this and add significance to the data and the information, because really we want to go from data to information to knowledge and then finally to wisdom, and wisdom is where a person acts. Recently, it's just a couple years ago, the National Biosurveillance Advisory Committee recommended that the Centers for Disease Control start actively experimenting with different types of social networks for biosurveillance, for just overall monitoring of the general public health. And if you'll notice, that's a late 2009 report. It's also specifically for pandemic preparation and response. This came out after the H1N1 pandemic. So we're looking at this passive data, seeing how can we use this on a national level to predict and respond to these massive events. And I think Mark's going to talk a little more about how you can, you know, what the technology is that makes that happen. Recently, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, published our social media and new media guidance policy. And even though a lot of this is just for internal, how we use these things, there's a couple key points I want to put out, that this affects NIH social media sites and NIH-funded social media sites. But the most important point is that what they baked into this is the concept of openness. When in doubt, the answer is open. And then we discuss the open, and if we need to close. I mean, even related to personally identifiable information. This is a massive tectonic shift, being open with this data, seeing what's possible, and then coming back and reforming if we have to do that. And then one of my favorite parts of this policy, if you're into this kind of stuff, you have little favorite parts of policies. So my favorite part is this first appendix, where they're talking about using social media for recruitment, for research studies and clinical trials. Again, this is massive. Previously, if you wanted to participate in a clinical trial, your clinician or specialist had to know about that trial, had to advocate for you to get in that trial. Then a few years ago, we launched clinicaltrials.gov, which, you know, crowdsources all the information from federally funded clinical trials so that citizens can see what's available. Now we're going to start actively recruiting on social media, and there are a ton of ethical, legal, privacy issues in that. But again, we're moving forward in an open way. Let's start with this and say this is a good thing that empowers citizens, and then let's have those discussions about ethics and privacy. And then finally, and this is a great segue to Mark, this is Dr. Sally Rocky, the Deputy Director for Extramural Research at the NIH. Extramural research is basically any research at the NIH that happens outside of the NIH, at a university like Hopkins, or maybe at a small business or a startup. 80% of NLM's of National Institutes of Health's $31 billion budget goes to extramural research. 80% of $31 billion is going outside the government to industry, to universities, to promote innovation. And this is the blog where Dr. Rocky talks about where that 80% is going and what we hope will happen with that. And like I said, I think it's a perfect segue from Mark and the great work he's doing at Hopkins.
Great.
I'm going to jump off this.
Yeah, have a song and dance.
We'll get a couple more steps on your Fitbit.
Right.
Hey, wow. That's a lot of money. I wanted to tell you a little bit about why I think social media and health go together, and specifically Twitter. I mean, when I first started telling people about this, it seemed a little bit strange, because this is what we think of when we think of Twitter, right? So these are all real tweets. Things like, nothing like waiting in line to buy cigarettes behind a guy in a business suit buying gasoline with $10 and dimes. Finally got my prenatal vitamins, and I'm at CVS, pharmacy, and then this is a Foursquare thing, so it's got the address. And this is really what Twitter is about. It's it's a microblog, and that means that people aren't really sitting down and thinking carefully about what they want to share. They're sharing things kind of as they're happening in their life. So these are not major events in someone's life, but it's kind of what they're doing. And so the question is, how does any of this inform what we can learn about health? And if you look at this a little more carefully, I think we actually can learn some things about health even from these tweets. So for example, the first person here, maybe they're a smoker and that's why they're buying cigarettes. The second person is, talking about prenatal vitamins, or maybe they're pregnant. Actually, my friend just had a baby, and she tweeted the whole labor. It was pretty impressive. She's got something like 14,000 tweets or something. It's very impressive. Not during the labor, overall. But I checked. I asked her if it was her husband or her, and she said it was her, so okay. And then I'm at CVS Pharmacy, so maybe this person is sick, maybe they're picking up a prescription. So we can't obviously conclude from these tweets that the first person's a smoker, or the second person's pregnant, or anything like that. But if we aggregate over millions and millions of tweets, we don't really care if the first person's a smoker or not. We want to know what the overall smoking rate is, or what the overall pregnancy rate is. And it turns out you can actually get really useful signal out of this data, and I think that was really surprising. So the sorts of techniques we use are the things that I do, statistical language processing. And we're able to do things like this. I wanted to give you just a couple examples of what we've been able to churn out by looking at Twitter with these techniques. So this is the flu season from 2009 to 2010, so it's a couple years old. And for some of you might know, the CDC tracks this, and they basically collect samples from hospitals across the country, they test them, and they put out a rate of what the current flu rate is in the United States. It takes them about 2 weeks to turn this around. So a couple years ago, Google.org said, I bet we can do this faster using search results. And that's Google.org's flu trends. And that's real time. And so this is what we would call Twitter flu trends, where the blue line here is what we predict from Twitter what the flu rate is. And you see it actually tracks the real flu rate very, very well. So this says that people are talking about things on Twitter with regard to health, and we can actually figure this out automatically and come up with a real-time analysis. So what's really exciting here is it's not just flu, but we can do lots of different things. So something else we did is we looked at allergy season. So this is a map of the U.S. in April 2010. Darker color means more people are tweeting about having allergies. Lighter colors are less people. And this is all just from Twitter. And how many people have allergies, seasonal allergies? Okay, so this should not surprise you. Basically, if you live in the Northeast or Midwest, April is not a good time to have allergies, right? Really dark colors. And if you look at these maps change over the year, you see allergy season rise and fall, and it rises and falls in different parts of the country at different times, right? Because basically, the allergy season varies by where you are in the United States. And so this was not surprising in the sense that we knew this about the United States. What's surprising is that we can automatically map this just based on what people are talking about on Twitter. And we have lots of results like this. We have results about exercise, obesity, cancer, smoking, how people use medications. It's really cool. To give you one other example, as you guys know, antibiotics are used to treat bacterial infections, but a lot of people don't know that. They think that they can be used for viruses. So a lot of people just think that taking antibiotics will help them with the flu. Right? This is not true, but people have antibiotics at home in their medicine cabinets, and they do it anyway. Right? And so we are automatically able to discover how many people are talking about using antibiotics to treat the flu and doing that incorrectly. And people who are into public health and care about public health are really interested in that sort of thing. They want to know, what do people think, what do people believe about health, what might be not true, and how can we correct that? So I really think there's tremendous potential here. I just wanted to show you some of the things we've done. But these are things we're thinking about doing next. Like, how do people use medications, right? We can get people actually tweeting about what drugs they're taking for what illnesses, and they might not be sharing that information with their doctors even. And believe it or not, people share with the world on Twitter what they don't tell their doctor. It's kind of surprising. And certainly what they don't tell their parents, okay? Discovering patient safety issues. I have students working on this right now. It's a really cool topic. Mental health diagnosis. How can we track drug and alcohol use, right? That's really key. This is primarily younger population, and they're actually tweeting what drugs they're taking and when they're drinking and all these things. Stopping medical misinformation. Opinions about drugs and vaccines. So people have looked at how opinions about vaccines on Twitter were influenced by things like statements Michelle Bachmann made and things like this. So it's really cool, and I think this is really an open question about what's in this data, because it's so big and we don't even know what's there, and kind of exploring it to figure out how we can use it for health.
All right. Thank you, Mark. So how many of you are a little scared now? Anyone? Okay. A couple people.
Thank goodness.
So we're going to talk a little bit about privacy now, mm-hmm. and
you know, it's clear to me that optimizing this data is important and necessary, but I'm sure not everyone feels that way, and there are also many privacy implications to consider. I'm going to share a couple of slides from actually a study that Edelman launched just this past week, just to put this in context, and then Devin's going to provide a little more insight into what we should be considering. So just the approach, quickly, it was a 7-country study, ages 18 plus, 1,000 people in the U.S., 500 for other countries, online. So people are caring more about the security of their personal information than ever before. This is probably because more of it is out there. And about 68% of people feel that they have even lost control of the information. They're not in control of it. They don't realize what's in the public domain and how people are using it. So the communication about this information is not clear. And that has to be corrected if we want to actually be using this effectively to improve public health, to expand the use of this, and to build business. And more than a quarter surveyed are actually most concerned about their health data privacy. If you look at the kinds of information here, the things at the top are the kinds of information that people share most often digitally. But health information is actually at a fairly significant number, I think, for the number of people that actually share this particular set of data, which is actually going to be increasing, which I think is what's most important here, is that as more information comes online and is shared digitally, the number of people actually concerned about this data is going to increase. And the health institutions are actually not meeting the needs of public that they serve. You'll see that 78% of people believe that privacy and security in medical and health industry is actually really important, but 51% of people actually don't trust those institutions to actually help them and protect the data. So there's a gap that we need to fill. And of course, you know, there's a premium on security. The premium on security actually translates into adoption of consumers and building business. So if you look at hospitals and pharmaceutical companies, you know, people are willing to, you know, consumers indicate the willingness to leave information online if personal information was accessed without their permission. And they're most conservative. They're most concerned with, again, financial institutions that they probably work with most often, but the concern at hospitals and pharma companies is still significantly large. So, you know, with these complicating factors, Devin, I'm hoping you can help us shed some light on what we should be considering, what complications we should be working within, and also looking at health information and health institutions, but not just health, because the companies that are not health, I think, are probably the ones that they're the ones collecting more data than any other. So if you can help clarify that.
Sure. So one of the things that I just want to make sure we level set, which is to make sure that people understand that the health data is not all protected by HIPAA. Right. So most people know what HIPAA is. If you've ever been to a doctor and you've been given a HIPAA form to sign, it's an acknowledgement that there are a set of privacy and security rules that apply to health data, but only in the context of most healthcare providers, your health insurance company, an entity called a healthcare clearinghouse, which most people don't know what they are. Quite frankly, I've never met anybody who does clearinghouse work, but they basically do data standardization activities, and their business contractors, like the billing company that helps your doctor get paid. They get your data, but they're covered by HIPAA. But when a consumer shares their health data on the internet or puts it up on a mobile application, none of that is covered by HIPAA. And people, I think, don't necessarily realize that they express a high degree of sensitivity with respect to this data in surveys. And I was happy to see the Edelman data, but it's basically a repeat of some of, not, I mean, a repeat, not meaning to be insulting, but these levels of concern about health data are consistently high across many years and maybe even increasing, at least when people are asked in surveys. Now, what they do in their behavior online sometimes doesn't necessarily reflect the same level of concern. I haven't seen any really good data to drill down on why this is the case, but we have always suspected that people think it's more protected than it is. Essentially, when data is being shared outside of the HIPAA context, it's largely covered by the commitments made in a privacy policy. If you put out a privacy policy as a company, you have to abide by it, and the Federal Trade Commission can come down on you if you don't. But you don't actually really have to have a privacy policy, and you don't have to make certain commitments in your privacy policy, and your privacy policy can, in fact, say, we sell your data to anybody who will buy it. Because there isn't anything that prohibits people from doing that. So we have a real disparity in terms of a legal environment for protections for this data. And the tricky part to resolving it is, how do you create an environment where consumers can share their data if they want to, understand what they're getting into when they do so? Because a lot of privacy policies are not that easy to read. You know, most people click through them, and I actually do that as well. I just don't do a lot of data sharing on the internet to the extent that I can avoid it. I am on Facebook, but I don't click on any of the apps and sharing vehicles, and I have very few apps on my phone. I don't do Fitbit. I don't load up data and health data onto any application. Not necessarily because I'm a nervous Nelly, although I suspect that I'm more so than maybe the rest of my fellow panelists and maybe the majority of you out there, except the people that raised their hands and admitted that they were scared. But because I don't trust a privacy policy to tell me what everyone is doing with the data that I might enter, because inevitably, and you know, with all due respect to companies, they're actually really hard to get right. If you tell people exactly what you're doing with data, you'll have a privacy policy that's pages long. And on an internet or a mobile application that's incredibly hard to scroll through, hardly anybody will read it. If you're shorter and to the point, you have to sort of use general terms like, you know, we use your data for quality improvement purposes. And most people would probably say yes to that, but it doesn't really tell you a whole lot. So it is really difficult to get it right. The administration is trying to come up with some private sector initiatives to try to get companies out in this space to adopt kind of voluntary codes of conduct about how they handle data that give a high degree of control to people about data sharing, largely an opt-in model for sharing, especially for sensitive data. But they also call on companies to be very focused with respect to the use of their data in terms of use what you need, but don't over-collect and over-retain. This, to me, implications for the identifiability of data. Much of the data mining that takes place is with aggregate data. There's not zero risk of re-identification, but there's much less risk of re-identification, and so therefore it has provides greater protection for people's individual privacy because they're just one person in a big glob of data versus necessarily the data being particular to them. On the other hand, targeted behavioral advertising is done at the micro individual level where, you know, ideally they want to track it, you know, where you've been on the internet so that they can serve you ads that are more likely to reflect something that you would be interested in. So, I mean, I think it's a real dilemma. You know, Emily started this by calling on companies to sort of think about both what they can do for health with the data that they're collecting in the daily course of business, and I would wholeheartedly agree with that, but I think the additional commitment has to come in the way of not breaching the public's trust, because we know there's an awful lot of people for whom health privacy is not a big concern. Even though they say so in a survey, they don't act like it when they share data. On the other hand, we also know that about 1 out of 6 people will not seek treatment. And in this context, they won't take advantage of some apps that could be very helpful for them because they don't trust where the data is going. And so if we don't pay attention to this, we'll essentially have this, the haves and the have-nots, but not in terms of money, in terms of sort of people being able to enjoy the benefits of being part of this open data sharing community. Are we going to have the benefits just for those who are not squeamish? Or can we find a way to do this in a way where the squeamish can be part of this too?
Really interesting. Thank you. I like how you pitted the health personalization against the advertising.
Yeah.
That we can be learning from other industries even though we have different complications to be considering.
Yeah, well, and advertising is tough because advertising in the healthcare context is a way to reach out to people to tell them about things that might actually improve their health, right? So it becomes really difficult to sort of regulate what's the good and what's the bad, not bad, but things that people should be protected against having their data used for without some sort of constraints.
Right. Thank you. So I'm hoping we can turn now to the business opportunity and what businesses should be considering, and actually a good lead on from what you were discussing at the end of your couple of minutes, Devin. You know, I believe businesses have an opportunity to actually, and responsibility to actually do something with their data. But I'm hoping Anmol and Mark, you guys can share a little bit about what you're seeing from the business perspective, what the business opportunity is, and what sort of ethical complications that there may be if you're collecting personal data. Should you be selling it? Is it okay if you're improving the public health at the same time? And just give some specifics to that end.
So I'll start by talking about two issues that come directly of Devin's points, which really are make this problem really hard, right? So first is terms of second use. So when data is collected via Facebook or Twitter, and that data can actually help inform your health outcomes, what defines those second use terms? Because you didn't opt in for the health insights from some of the sources submitted for us. And I think that's something that makes this tricky. The other thing that makes this tricky is the data ownership model, right? So today, the data exists, but it sits on Verizon servers and it sits on Facebook servers and all these other places. So this goes back to the point I made earlier, is the ownership is really working. And so at Ginger.io, we have our sort of privacy philosophy, and we're trying to work hard on a lot of the details, but there's a few principles that we think make a lot of sense, right? So first is, you have to get consumers to opt in, at least given the context. You have to have people accept that, look, this is how the data is going to be used, and I realize that it's for a health application. And which is why we install the app on a person's phone and not work with any mobile operators. The second part, which is really important, is giving patients value out of the system, right? So the Gmail and Google AdWords example is everybody uses Gmail, even though it minds your email, is because it's the most, it's the easiest to use email program out there on the web. And so there's a direct trade-off between how much value you can give the users. In our case, we try to do that by giving users the ability to set who they can reach out to, or how the system's configured to send notifications and so on. So you control that. And the third is sort of recognizing that users own their data and users decide how to share. And so it really is your data, and if you want to delete it or if you don't want to share it, then you should have the rights to do that across the system. So I think those are a few of the examples of how we think about the problem.
Yeah, so I have to say, I've been really excited by the sorts of things companies are doing. You've talked about Ginger.io. To give you other examples, this company Sick Weather that looks at what your friends are putting online about on their social networks, about what diseases they have and if they're feeling sick, what symptoms they have. And you can actually log in, and if you're feeling sick, figure out what your friends might be suffering from, and why you might be sick, right? Who came to the party that got everyone sick, right? And there's companies like Health Map, which is looking at identifying public health trends. And these are really cool things. I'm really excited. But as you talked about, privacy is a big issue, and just to emphasize how murky this is, I think if we took someone's public tweet data and we used it and we looked at it, I think everyone agrees that's okay, because this is public data, anyone can look at it. But what happens if we start making predictions from that data, we start deriving things from the data? So let me give you examples of things that we've done at Hopkins. So based on your Twitter data, we can predict what your gender is, we can predict what your age is, we can predict your ethnicity, we can predict your political affiliation. So you've put that information out there, even though you never said what your gender was, you're putting the information out there voluntarily, but maybe you never agreed to have anyone make these conclusions, right? And it's very murky about when are these conclusions maybe invasive of your privacy and when are they not. And we've seen examples of this, I think, other companies. So how many people know about this Target advertising campaign and spread, right? So basically Target knows what you buy, and they make predictions about what you might buy in the future, and they can do things like notice you're buying prenatal vitamins and figure out that you're pregnant, and so start sending you advertisements for baby stuff. And this father got really upset because his teenage daughter was getting these ads. Tell me if I get this wrong.
No, you got it right.
I got it right? Okay. His daughter was getting these teenage ads for baby products, and he went into the Target and complained, and then came back a couple days later and apologized, because apparently his daughter was pregnant, and he just had no idea. So Target knows more about what's going on in your household. Now, that data is private, but look at Facebook. So there was I don't know what capacity this was, but Facebook, someone was talking about trying to identify Facebook status updates of people who are suicidal, right? So if someone starts talking in suicidal language, you obviously want to, intervene in some way. But imagine the privacy and the ethical considerations. If Facebook knows who's suicidal,
right? What obligation does that give them to do something? Do they have to intervene? Do they have to call the person? Is that a violation of the person's privacy? I mean, it almost makes you not want to collect that data in the first place. But we are collecting that data because it's so useful. And I just have no idea what we're going to do about all this. So
maybe someone in the audience.
Yeah, maybe
help
you guys
can
help.
Light.
I got it. So we randomly insert GoSentorum every once in a while so we can figure out your Democrat.
There's a business opportunity here for obfuscating your profile.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
But what type of obfuscation are people comfortable with? So I don't know how many people explicitly say on their Twitter feed, I am a man or a woman, but probably most people aren't too upset if someone figures that out, right? Now, in some cases, there was this, someone pretending to be a gay woman in Syria. Do I have that right? Does everyone remember this?
No.
Yeah, okay, some people. And it got a lot of following. It turned out to be a guy doing it, right? And pretending to be it. Right, so like exposing that level of deception, or I mean, I don't know if it was supposed to be explicit deception. I mean, this is really complicated. I mean, what do people want to obfuscate? What do people not want to obfuscate? And it's not clear at all what we should do here.
Well, with that in mind, if you guys want to start either lining up, or this gentleman here can come to you with a microphone, and we can begin to ask some questions. Curious to hear what everyone else thinks about this this particular topic and anything else that we have.
Yeah, front up here.
I was just going to say from changing data, like maybe about a year ago, I started noticing all these things on Facebook, all the targeted ads. So I changed my birth year to about 100 years ago. So it thinks I'm 100 years old, and I started getting all these AARP ads and all these different things, but that it's interesting about trying to disrupt that a little bit somehow.
Yeah.
As I should say, as a married man, I get a lot of ads for single events on Facebook.
And what does your wife think about that?
I mean, I started complaining, but maybe it's not such a bad advertising policy. I don't know.
I have two things I want to say. One is social networks do not replace human interaction. So, yes, it may be a violation of privacy for somebody to reach out to somebody who is exhibiting suicidal behavior, but at the same time, it's not Facebook's job to be your mom. Your mom should be your mom, and I don't think that that issue ever gets brought up. And my other point is, while you may be having marketers approach you because of the information you put out there, you still don't have to buy their products. So again, there's personal choice involved in all of these things, and we don't ever really talk about that.
Well, absolutely true. And on the other hand, do we have any control at all over what data the marketers get in order to service those ads? And I think for some people, it's not enough to be able to just say no when the ad is served. For some people, it's, I don't want to be served ads about a deeply personal health product that I was trying to get, or service that I was trying to find information on the internet, because that's the best place to find something, and it's the best resource for gathering information, and yet I don't have a way today of doing that in a way that's not going to end up serving me potentially ads about that are related to that, you know, sort of deeply personal product. And so my choices are, don't use the internet to search for that. Find some other way to find information, or suck it up and deal and just say no and don't buy the product. But to me, it's not enough. That I would like to see choice applying earlier in that framework. I completely agree with you that ultimately you don't have to buy anything that anybody advertises to you.
And it's right. But, and it's not just the ads, though. It's where that information goes and the other places that people, the other people and institutions that might have access to the data. So it goes beyond the targeted advertising, I think that's important.
It certainly does, but that's the business model that is driving a lot of internet business models. So,
and just to add one note, so I don't think we're talking about replacing doctors or parents or anything like that. A lot of what I look at is augmenting them and helping them do their job. But let's say Facebook could accurately identify people who are suicidal. Do they have an obligation to do that?
let's give some
I mean,
love to
I have no idea.
To that side of the room for a moment.
Does anyone here work for Facebook?
Hi, I'm a pediatrician, and I work with a population that uses social media and uses media excessively for interaction socially, but their level of distrust for other things is pretty high as well. But as a provider, their trust of me is pretty strong because we've established that face-to-face relationship. But my ability to be able to use that data to help them and to work with them is an opportunity for me to provide better care, such that if there's a relationship to using that data so that I can provide better care, I think that would work for them if they knew that it was something that was coming to me as opposed to something that was going out into the world. But I mean, to me, that's an opportunity. But it also requires an interaction with the provider and the provider being in that loop of analyzing and looking at the data.
Yeah. So this raises a really good point. So how many people here have sent an email today? Just raise your hand. Okay. How many people have ever emailed their doctor? All right. So that's not bad. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's
but
pretty good.
Why hasn't everyone emailed the doctor? Right? Like, this seems like a really natural way to communicate with people. It's much... Right? So doctors don't want to is certainly part of it. But when you're talking about in younger populations, you know, teenagers, for example, I mean, this is how they communicate, right? And there should be a way that the medical community can tap into that. And I think there's tremendous opportunity, but again, all these privacy and ethical concerns quickly rise to the surface. So these are things that I think, certainly at Hopkins, we're thinking about. Like, how can we use social networks for doctor-patient communications? How do we use them in educating medical students? How do we use them within hospitals and healthcare systems? I mean, there's so many questions here because there's so much potential.
And also, a lot of what's happening in this space is in the startup community. And so the event that I was mentioning, just I think in the opening remarks, the Health Data Initiative that's taking place in June in Washington, D.C., that's a space where the government data providers, clinicians, the startups, the patients and patient advocates come together to see, you know, what's happening around this data, what are the opportunities, and everything from developing business models to discussing these issues. That's the place where all of this conversation happens, and I think there's a unique role for the startup community and for the government to support that, because they're the ones that can get out there and really aggressively and rapidly, you know, just iterate around this and test out different ideas. And so I think that's, if you're interested, just check that out, the Health Data Initiative. I can talk with you more about that.
Yeah, and the one thing I would add is, as Stu's pointed out, is it's not a technology problem at all. Like, none of these, you know, some of these communication issues are not technology problems. It's all process and business and legislation and all these other factors.
The easy stuff is what he's saying.
Yeah. I was going to add, I'm also a pediatrician, and I go to a lot of Health 2.0 conferences, and I think it's very, very important to understand that the empowered patients that attend these conferences are not the average patients who are on the outside, okay? And I think that's very, very important when we talk about this open data. I have patients constantly try to reach me in public spaces, and they have no idea that dialogue is not private. Okay, they don't know the privacy settings surrounding Facebook, they don't know the privacy settings surrounding Twitter. I don't allow that kind of dialogue, but they still reach out to me. And these patients have absolutely no idea. And I think there's an obligation to these folks, to National Library of Medicine, that significant resource be put into educating these patients as to what exactly is going on.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because my second favorite section of the NIH's social media and new media policy, I'm not making this up, my second favorite section is the section that focuses on education of NIH staff and those working on NIH contracts about the common misconceptions that patients have about sharing this data. And that, you know, when we're out on Facebook and we're out on Twitter, we're sort of opening our arms and saying, come, you can engage with your government through these social media channels, but we need to be aware that citizens don't necessarily have that deep regulatory and legal understanding, and that we need, in addition to health literacy, we also need to address these technology and communication literacy
Private
issues.
Literacy.
I mean, we've talked before, but I'd, you know, love to talk more about this, because it is something we're starting to focus more and more on.
We assume everyone's like ePatient Dave, and ePatient Dave does not necessarily represent the knowledge level of the average person.
There's a question.
Sorry, go ahead.
Hey, thanks. This is a great panel. So I'm one of the other statistical natural language processing guys in the room, and I'm a bit of a privacy nut. I'm one of those people who clears the cache in my browser every time I get off of it.
I knew there had to be at least one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I do work with clinical records in sort of a business context, and it seems to me that there's an opportunity that hasn't been discussed that may also kind of address some of the issues that we're talking about here. The clinical records, the full patient record, the dictations and everything else, are things that covered entities, you know, under HIPAA do have access to. It seems to me that connecting the social media data with the clinical records data is an enormous opportunity in terms of leveraging as big an opportunity as personalized medicine connecting the genome with the patient data, and so I'm kind of curious as to whether there's been any discussion of that amongst the folks that the panel works with, and B, it seems to me that HIPAA covered entities know an awful lot about patient privacy, and so one thing that one could do is encourage organizations that already have that status to be doing R&D with the social media data.
Just a couple more. Did you want to ask a question? Maybe we can ask.
So can I say something?
Yes, go ahead.
So, this is huge. And this is something we thought of. I've talked to people at Hopkins about doing this. So the clinical data is massive right now. You have a whole talk on clinical data and statistical methods Tuesday, right?
Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah. Okay, great. So you should go to that. But, I mean, we thought about doing this, and we immediately, like, the first problems we run into are... HIPAA organizations are terrified of it because they know HIPAA and they look at this data and they're like, how do we do that, right? So when you go to IRBs, for example, which have to approve all human-related research, and you say, oh, I want to engage with people on social media, for example. So here's something really simple. I'm going to find people on social media that are saying things that might be wrong, and I'm going to correct them. Whoa, you can't just engage people on social media and share clinical information with them. I mean, you just can't do that. So we're trying to think about how to do this, and I think you're right that HIPAA organizations can share a lot of information with the rest of us, but it's really hard to overcome those barriers. Right. So and we are thinking about it.
And I just want to add, you know, we started off by looking at all the different kinds of information and data that we're collecting and how they're each advancing so rapidly, looking at genomic, personal, behavior, active, EHRs, that kind of thing, and connecting the dots is really where it becomes important. And by actually... pulling all that data together, that's when we can actually look at targeted therapy and targeted approaches. And I think that's where I think the opportunity lies for us. So.
And also one quick point, it seems like it's not the data set that has the value, it's mashing up multiple data sets. Yeah. That's when you start to really extract the value.
Which is why this is so important, because it's the behavioral piece that's added to the genome, that's added to the epigenome.
But of course you can't connect dots with aggregate data, right?
Right.
You have to be able to personalize it, and there's a high degree of regulation in the clinical context on individually identifiable data versus data that's in the aggregate.
Yeah,
I mean, one point I would make on that, though, is given all the registration, sort of the issues, it's really hard to do it today. And so the model that's worked for us is there's a difference between the clusters of behavior changes you see using mobile phone data and the exact diagnosis, right? And I don't know if you guys think about this, but we don't think ourselves as diagnostic. And, you know, we probably would never be a diagnostic. And it really is an idea of saying, hey, someone else needs to be charged. So you're solving almost a related but different problem, right? And you can get around and do it today if you have permission from the user, if you've done the right things, and so on. And so I think it's actually better today to not try to combine those because you can build your applications as a startup.
So one of the things I'm interested in is this notion that if you take people, say, just arbitrarily 10 to 40, we have a large population of what I would call sort of normally healthy people who are sort of outside of the system. They don't engage with their doctors and allied health professionals on a regular basis unless they have a chronic condition or something happens to them. And so they're outside of a context where we can talk to them in a situation where we could start to talk to them about future health behaviors. And what I'm interested in is this notion that we could create the proper... you know, contextualized private network or collection of data so that we could start actually sort of pushing towards people the kind of sort of behavioral diagnoses so we can prepare people for the times when they're going to need these behaviors. So if for example, compliance. You know, maybe there's something we can find in people's data that sort of says, let's improve your compliance towards walking, or let's improve your sensitivity to these types of issues in such a way that when they get to the point where that data actually matters, we not only have baseline, but perhaps we've often worked with them in an engagement method that doesn't involve the health apparatus. Because if we push all these healthy people towards that health apparatus to engage them ahead of time, they won't be able to, we can't service that. So we have to create this alternative context.
Thank you. So I think we can address that, but I think we can put in the context of some closing remarks where I'm going to ask everybody to talk about very quickly just some predictions over the next 5 years and what needs to happen to realize those.
I'll go ahead and start. I think it's going to be big data mashups with data that government's making available, connected with information that will be able to be shared through more developed health information exchanges. That's going to create the exponential jump in this information to correct the dots with the research that's happening with the clinicians, with the startup community, that we're really going to start to see, you know, maybe less e-patient Daves and more mini e-patient Daves everywhere.
Does anybody remember trying to install an app on their phone in 2005? And there were, you know, 9 different phone platforms and 6 different operating systems, and every mobile operator had their own little API changes that no one knew about, and it was impossible to do anything. I think healthcare is in that state right now. It's so hard to, there's so many bureaucracies and so many layers of complexity, and it's not a technology problem, as I said before. It's a process, and figuring out, you know, what's happening on the government side and what's happening on the sort of startup side and the researcher side, all of those are interesting. I think what I hope we'll see is a model where when you have an interesting, compelling product, you can go to market and you can validate it on the same cycle that Facebook and Zynga use, which is 1 year, and not 3 years, which is what healthcare traditionally does.
So I'll keep it simple. So we have a tremendous amount of data today, social media data, clinical data, mobile health data, and I think in the next 5 years, the methods and techniques we use will catch up to the amount of data we have now. But 5 years from now, the amount of data we have will dwarf anything we can imagine today. So I'm not sure how we're ever going to catch up, but I hope we can over the next couple of years.
And in keeping with Mark's comment, I think that the cost pressures that will drive both different payment models in the healthcare system as well as more patient responsibility for paying for their own care, coupled with initiatives around getting providers to adopt clinical records that will have patient portals in them in 2014 to give patients more and more easier access to their data is going to explode all of this, even more than is already the case today.
Great. Well, thanks so much, everybody, for coming. If you asked a question, we have shirts for you, so feel free to come up and get them.
Yeah.
And we'd love to talk to anyone.
Yeah, and we're still here. There were some hands up that didn't get
Thank you, everybody.
That we didn't have a chance to reach, so come on up.